This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Welcome to the world of Forbes, Barron's, and Fortune magazines. This is brought to you by the good folks at Mind's Eye Organization. My name is Greg Conroy. So let's get down to business. We'll start with Forbes magazine. New billionaire, a Titanic success. Having grossed $10 billion at the box office across his career, James Cameron is now in the most exclusive club in Hollywood. This was written by Matt Craig. Over the course of his 40 years in the movie business, director James Cameron has increasingly made big bets on his projects while facing sky-high expectations to always produce a motherload of box office gold, beginning in the 1980s with The Terminator and Aliens, and extending through Titanic and the first two Avatar films, the 71-year-old Oscar winner's movies have collectively earned some $10 billion at the global box office. His share of that forms the bulk of a personal net worth that Forbes now estimates to be $1.1 billion. That puts Cameron on the short list of filmmakers who have achieved billionaire status, including George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Peter Jackson, and Tyler Perry. Unlike the others who had significant deals or revenue streams outside Hollywood, Cameron has reached the mark almost entirely from the success of his movies. Yet in interviews, he demurs any mention of his wealth through a representative he declined to be interviewed for this story. Quote, "I wish I was a billionaire," close quote, Cameron said in a recent podcast interview with Puck's Matt Baloney. Quote, "The billionaire thing assumes certain deals that didn't exist, one, and two, that I've never spent a dime in 30 years, close quote. In the coming months, he's only going to get richer. Forbes estimates that Cameron stands to make at least $150 million before taxes and fees on Avatar, Fire and Ash, assuming the movie lives up to its lofty box office expectations. By early January, it had already crossed the $1 billion mark, but it will likely fall short of the $2 billion haul brought in by each of its two predecessors. Cameron has been steadfast that he has plans for a fourth and fifth Avatar film, but indicated that this movie would once again have to prove itself at the ticket office for the next batch of sequels to get the go-ahead. Quote, "It's kind of nuts, right?" close quote, he recently said of his maximalist production style. Quote, "If we hadn't made so much damn money with the first film, we'd never be doing this. I mean, it's insane." Here's a sidebar. Top of the Pops. In a year in which Beyonce became a billionaire and the other 10-figure pop superheroine Taylor Swift entered her engagement era while releasing her The Life of a Showgirl album, it was the pop star known as The Weeknd who ended 2025 on the highest note. In December, the 36-year-old pop star announced he was selling a stake in his existing catalog to Lyric Capital in a deal reported to be worth $1 billion. Forbes estimates that he pocketed $200 million, ending the year with $298 million in earnings. Here are the five highest-paid musicians of 2025. The Weeknd, $298 million. Taylor Swift, $202 million. Beyonce, $148 million, Kendrick Lamar, $109 million, and Coldplay, $105 million. And now for Forbes 30 Under 30. Acquisitive agents. Sleek apparel, Hot Wheels, bespoke colorways. Using AI to change the way we shop with the Forbes 30 Under 30 in 30 words or less. Here are the top six. Phoebe Gates, 23, and Sophia Chiani, 24, are co-founders of Fia of New York, New York. Before picking up that dream handbag, look for a better deal on Fia. The fashion app, backed by $43 million in investing, canvasses the web to find cheaper secondhand sellers and similar items. Arya Keshavarzian, 29 years old, co-founder of Lux Concierge in Los Angeles. This valet service, backed by investments totaling $15 million, helps folks source and negotiate leases for BMWs, Audis, and other luxury vehicles. AI organizes its inventory and seamlessly processes transactions. Bridger Hart, 26 years old. Carson Hart, 29 years old. Co-founders of Hoppin in Hermosa Beach, California. Crave Cerulean Scarves are a painting, primarily puce. The brothers quote-unquote infinite search widget backed by $1.4 million in investing, scans for goods in specific hues and patterns, delighting shoppers everywhere. Julia O'Mara, 28 years old, co-founder of Pickle, New York, New York. Shop other people's closets. Pickle is a peer-to-peer buy or rent clothing market backed by $20 million that uses AI to scour more than 350,000 pieces for vibe-tastic looks. Here's a sidebar article. The price of the great life. Inflation has come for the Forbes 400 set, too. Our cost of living extremely well index, CLEWI, which has tracked a basket of ultra-luxe goods since 1982, rose by 5.5% over the past year, double the consumer price index. It's never been more expensive to live like a billionaire. Saunas are up 5.9%, sailing yachts 6.9%, and thoroughbred horses more than 20%, thanks to a provision in the One Big Beautiful Bill cementing the ability to turn the four-legged money pits into 1,100-pound tax write-offs. Here are some of the steepest increases. Plus 25.9% versus last year. Sporting shotguns. James Purdy and Sons 12-bore pair, Griffin and Howe, New Jersey. Price, $467,327. Up 22.6%. Thoroughbred. Average price of a yearling Keeneland September sale, Kentucky, $647,522. Plus 11.1%. Private concierge, one-year bespoke membership, Pure Entertainment Group, Montreal, Quebec, $200,000. Up 9.2%. Caviar, kilo of Petrosian Special Reserve Ocetra, California and New York, at $14,180. And up 6.2% from last year, a swimming pool. Olympic-sized mission pools from California are $5,816,000. That was all written by Alexander York. Supersonic youth. Becoming a billionaire is increasingly a young person's game, it seems. 31-year-old Maddie Staniszewski, net worth $1.1 billion, co-founder of AI speech generator 11 Labs, graced the cover of Forbes' annual 30 Under 30 issue. He and his business partner, Piotr Dubkowski, also 31 years old, $1.1 billion, originally surfaced on our Under 30 Europe in 2024. They now join 44 other List alumni who have minted 10-figure fortunes since our inaugural Under 30 issue in 2012. Quote, massive congratulations to 11 Labs, and what a proud moment for the European tech community, close quote, cheered Paul Guzik on LinkedIn. Quote, makes my Polish heart very happy, close quote. Last year witnessed the emergence of 8 billionaires under 30, including Polymarket's Shane Coplin, 27 years old, and all three 22-year-old co-founders of AI recruiting unicorn Mercor. Unsurprisingly, AI-centric entrepreneurs, none yet billionaires, were well represented in the under 30 class of 2026, with standouts including Jesse Zhang, 28 years old, co-founder of $1.5 billion A&I customer service developer Decagon, and Eunice Wu, 26 years old, who is a CIFA, uses AI to streamline Mesozoic-era pharmacy operations. Quote, every year the list gets more impressive, said at Shivanal Hussein on Instagram. Quote, congratulations to all the innovators pushing boundaries, close quote. Smooth talkers. London-based 11 Labs founders were inspired to build better AI voice tech after growing up in Poland, watching poorly dubbed U.S. films that often had a lone, monotonous lector drearily acting out the parts. The startups convincing AI voices have made its two millennial co-founders billionaires. Is it time to pass the mic to the robots? Readers spoke out. From one reader, replacing artists who work for a living with AI voices? Nah. Finally, I speak both Polish and English and feel bad for those who have to watch amazing movies with Polish lectors. Completely takes away from the actor's performance. Quote, not sure what's wrong with lectors' voiceovers. Rather have them than the Polish actor's AI pretending to be Brad Pitt. Sounds like a solution to problems that didn't exist. Close quote. Quote, what I appreciate most is the focus on making technology feel more human, not just more powerful. Close quote. Travis Maston wrote, quote, are these the folks responsible for the more realistic-sounding robocalls I've been getting? Credit where it's due. I've noticed more realistic verbal tics, pacing, and voicing variety, Still, obviously, AI-generated content, still annoying and scammy, close quote. And finally, quote, people call 11Labs success luck. It's not. It's what happens when you pick one hard problem, go deep, and ship faster than the giants who overthink everything, close quote. Assisted flight. Brink founder Blake Resnick told Forbes he's optimistic that his Seattle-made police drones will snatch the huge American market away from DJI, the dominant Chinese giant. Tall order. About 80% of public safety groups with drone fleets use DJI. Just 7% favor Brink. Resnick's $480 million company, though deeply unprofitable per Forbes estimates, does boast some prominent outfits testing its tech, chief among them the New York Police Department. At Scott Don'tgram is rooting for Resnick. Quote, DJI is a joke, and American amateur drone operators don't seem to understand or appreciate the massive national security risk that comes from using them, close quote. D.C. regulators apparently do. In late December, the Federal Communications Commission banned all future DJI equipment from sale in the U.S. Resnick, a 2022 Forbes 30 Under 30 alumnus, must be thrilled, having spent $660,000 lobbying for exactly that. Cops who generally find Brink's drones inferior to DJI's are less psyched. Echoing them, Michael Pastushkov groused on Facebook that, quote, competitors should be eliminated by better products, not by government, close quote. That was written by Simone Melvin. Coming up, The New Age Oracle of Omaha by Sergei Klebnikov. Omani Carson pulled himself out of poverty by building a service business based on a contradiction. Keep things personal while scaling like crazy. Now the billionaire financial advisor has donned a fur-trimmed poncho and started taking psychedelics while striving to, quote, optimize for joy, close quote. An afternoon birthday party for Omani Carson's three-year-old granddaughter is raging in his house, nestled along a golf course on a dead-end street in Omaha, Nebraska. Toys and party decorations litter the living room, where the kids are bouncing among games, television, and cake. Carson steps away into his quiet downstairs office, walls lined with signed guitars and hunting rifles. Quote, we're never moving from here, close quote, he says, sitting at a polished wooden table. Quote, my CEO and best friend lives one house over. My kids are moving across the street. They renamed it the cul-de-sac, close quote. A few miles down the road, some of the 672 staffers at the headquarters of his $55 billion Carson Group are advising clients which stocks to buy and which to avoid, and dispensing wisdom about setting up a durable power of attorney or writing a living will. Others are helping other financial advisors around the country do the same. Quote, they're part of our extended family, close quote, Carson says. Quote, and we treat them that way, close quote. For four decades, while his first name was still Ron, Carson, who is 61 years old, built one of the largest registered financial advisor firms in the nation by leaning into personal relationships with his clients. He embraced scores of independent advisors looking for guidance, developing a coaching business to teach them his ways and a support operation to help with things like marketing, tech, and infrastructure. Today, his business has 150 partner offices serving 54,000 affluent families across the nation, up from 33,000 in 2020. Assets have surged more than threefold since 2021, when Carson sold a minority stake to Bain Capital at a $1 billion valuation. Now, thanks to a roughly 51% share of the company and some 16,000 acres of Nebraska farmland, Carson, a former Forbes contributor, is only the second billionaire financial advisor after Texas-based Ken Fisher, who also used to write for Forbes. But amid this huge success with his business at an all-time high, Carson took an unexpected turn. In 2022, after he hosted indigenous leaders from around the world at his remote hunting lodge turned Healing Ranch, a Lakota chief bestowed on him the name Tata Omani, meaning, quote, walking into a stiff wind, close quote. He legally changed his name. Ron would now go by Omani. He gave away all his neckties. He started taking psychedelics and fasting as part of what he described as a broader effort to heal himself. Quote, the first chapter of my life was just craving financial stability, close quote, he says. Quote, once I had it and it didn't give me the feeling I wanted, I searched for emotional stability, close quote. Now he says he's happier than ever, living a life of, quote, love and abundance, close quote, and has a plan and a new business to help other lost executives, quote, switch their operating systems, close quote. It's been a long journey from the cold fields of Nebraska, where Carson helped his alcoholic, sometimes abusive father run the family farm. At 17, he watched his overleveraged parents go bankrupt. Quote, it was the one and only time I saw my dad cry, close quote, Carson says. Quote, I had this relentless desire to not be poor because my parents went broke and it severed my soul, close quote. As a 265-pound defensive lineman on scholarship at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, he hustled to get rich. He lost his life savings of $10,000 betting on cattle futures with a quote-unquote unscrupulous broker, but found success selling insurance, cold-calling farmers at 6:30 a.m. straight out of the phone book. He sat at their kitchen tables connecting with them over foul weather, unruly crops, and busted equipment. Quote, people trusted me, close quote, he recalls. Quote, even though I was truly an unconscious incompetent, close quote. In 1983, he went into business for himself, launching what would become the Carson Group out of his dorm. He spent the next 6 years without an office, barely breaking even. Then on a particularly rough day, he began phoning clients simply to check in without an agenda. At a time when most wealth managers were extremely transactional, focused solely on selling investment products to clients, Carson made it personal. Quote, I learned people's kids' names, their pets' names, everything, close quote. Good strategy and good timing as everyday investors began moving money away from traditional brokers into the hands of registered investment advisors, which are legally required to act in clients' best interests rather than juice their commissions pumping affiliated products. Carson's annual revenue jumped from less than $30,000 to $1 million within 2 years. Despite operating far from Wall Street or Silicon Valley, he was soon the highest earning advisor in his broker-dealer network. As early as the mid-1990s, Carson began documenting his processes for even the smallest details, from how to greet a client to how to leave a voicemail. Quote, everything is repeatable, close quote, he says. Other advisors began traveling to Omaha to study his methods. In 1993, he launched Carson Coaching, offering subscription-based guidance and operational blueprints. In 2012, he started Carson Partners, which gives independent advisory firms access to shared technology compliance, marketing, and other infrastructure. But his bread and butter remains helping affluent households with investing, taxes, retirement, and estate planning in exchange for a flat percentage fee, up to 2.5% of assets managed. Quote, if you're following wealth advice, you probably know the Carson Group, close quote, says Philip Pellaviv, who runs a Seattle-based consultancy for financial advisors. Quote, it's a bit like if you're watching football, you probably know about the Pittsburgh Steelers, close quote. Yet as Carson's business compounded, his personal life frayed. A workaholic terrified of slipping back into poverty, he found his marriage strained. His mother died. He suffered from anxiety and depression. Traditional therapy didn't help. In 2016, a marriage counselor introduced Carson to Kourash Rasek, a therapist who once battled addiction and homelessness and who now focuses on trauma-informed and somatic approaches to healing. He encouraged Carson to step away from routines and confront deeper, fear-driven patterns. Quote, that was the first step in figuring out how to love myself, close quote, Carson says. Quote, I spent most of my life optimizing for success, but I never asked if I was optimized for joy, close quote. He cut back sharply on alcohol, restructured his schedule to cap meetings, and prioritized time with his grandchildren, and began immersing himself in retreats, hikes, and psychedelic-assisted sessions that he describes as quote-unquote medicine. After taking a psychedelic, he won't say which one, he found himself wandering the streets of Venice, California. Quote, people would smile at me and smile back, he says. I never noticed people before, close quote. He also reshaped how he ran his business. Employees became stakeholders. He put more money into internal leadership development and began pushing, quote, sustainable ambition, close quote, focusing on durability and succession rather than growth at all costs. He pushed leaders to share metrics, playbooks, and decision-making frameworks more openly. In 2024, he gave up the chief executive role, he remains chairman, and began devoting much of his time and several million dollars of his fortune to Omia, a buy-invitation-only venture he launched that year, targeting founders who are financially successful but personally stuck. Continuing in Forbes, 6 U.S. cities that feel like Europe, without the long-haul flight. Visit a Bavarian village in Texas, a Danish-designed town in California wine country, and an ancient Spanish city on the coast of Florida, by Emily Hochberg. From wandering cobblestone alleyways to sipping espresso in centuries-old courtyards, the draw of Europe is undeniable, but it doesn't always require crossing the Atlantic. Across the United States, a handful of towns strongly resemble those found in Europe, with quaint village squares and culturally rooted cuisine. Quote, many U.S. towns were intentionally designed and inspired by European architecture, culture, and traditions, whether that's Bavarian alpine villages, Swiss-inspired mountain towns, or southern cities with cathedral-lined squares, close quote, said Fiorella Iberi, a marketing manager at RV Share. Quote, once you're there, the cobblestone streets, local bakeries, historic buildings, and festivals make the experience feel immersive rather than themed, close quote. Boston, Massachusetts. While Boston is deeply tied to U.S. history, a fleet of English immigrants founded the city in 1630, modeling it after their former home. The town's earliest homes, meeting houses, public buildings, and public streets reflected those found in London and other old English cities, close, says Susan Wilson, the Omni Parker House historian. The best place to admire that likeness, says Wilson, is in Beacon Hill. Quote, Beacon Hill, topped by the gold-domed State House and developed in the late 18th and 19th centuries, features narrow, picturesque streets and alleys, Federal-style row houses, wrought iron railings, ornate doorways, fan lights, and real gas lamps. It is often compared to Old London, especially in the section known as Lewisburg Square, close quote, says Wilson. Later years brought additional European immigrants who also left their own visible mark on Boston. Quote, if you wander down Commonwealth Avenue in the area known as Back Bay, you feel as if you've entered Paris, close quote, says Wilson. Italy, meanwhile, waits in the North End. Quote, the narrow streets of this compact historic neighborhood are still filled with an endless array of old-world cafes, pasta restaurants, pastry shops, and summer festivals, maintaining the area's pride as Boston's Little Italy. According to Wilson, the best way to savor so much European sentiment is simple. Just start walking. Quote, in many parts of old downtown Boston, narrow streets still meander in seemingly illogical ways. We find that charming and an invitation to wander, close quote, says Wilson. Frankenmuth, Michigan. Bavaria is known for its alpine landscapes and fairy tale castles, yet thousands of miles away, a small Michigan town looks surprisingly similar. Dubbed Michigan's Little Bavaria, Frankenmuth was founded in 1845 by German missionaries, and their influence is still felt today. Quote, guests can hear German spoken, explore cultural traditions, and enjoy centuries-old influences, close quote, said Michael Keller Zender, the president and fourth-generation owner of Frankenmuth's Bavarian Inn Lodge. Scattered throughout town, find onion domes, red roofs, carved wooden shutters, and traditional architecture. Even the local McDonald's and CVS look plucked from Germany. Quote, great effort has been taken to transplant exact designs, paying homage to actual buildings, murals, and fountains visitors would see across Bavaria, close quote, Keller Zender said. Quote, keen-eyed visitors will recognize replicas of Rothenburg and Gunzenhausen's famous city towers, as well as the Austrian Silent Night Chapel. For souvenirs, peruse the atmospheric Frankenmuth River Place shops, then find nourishment at the Bavarian Inn restaurant, which is an authentic Glockenspiel inspired by Munich's famed clock tower. By ordering Wiener Schnitzel, Sauerbraten, and Spätzle from staff wearing traditional dirndls and lederhosen. The restaurant, along with Zender's of Frankenmuth, also makes family-style chicken dinners, a staple of Frankenmuth since the late 1800s. Vail, Colorado. In the early 1960s, World War II veteran Peter Siebert built Vail Ski Resort along with local rancher Earl Eaton. They drew inspiration from alpine resorts like Kitzbühel, Austria, and Zermatt, Switzerland, with its pedestrian-friendly, car-free village. Quote, Vail Village still looks and feels like the town center of Kitzbühel, close quote, says Johannes Vessler, fourth-generation owner of Sonnenalp Hotels, which opened Sonnenalp Hotel in Vail in 1979. Quote, one key element is the excellent pedestrian village layout full of shops, restaurants, and wonderful energy. Few villages in the U.S. or Europe can offer this at the level we have here in Vail. Close quote. Still family owned and operated, Sun and Alp Vail feels like checking into a historic European inn with its cream stucco walls, arched red roofing, Bavarian style furniture, and flower lined balconies. Also on site is the hotel's Swiss Chalet restaurant, which serves traditional Swiss dishes like warm, comforting fondue or decadent melted raclette, while Alpenrose Vail, a Bavarian-themed restaurant serving German and Swiss favorites, is a short walk away. And of course, what's a pseudo-trip to Europe without souvenirs? Stock up at Gorouche, a retail shop that carries apparel brands from Germany, Austria, Italy, and more. St. Augustine, Florida. The oldest continuously occupied European established settlement in the U.S., St. Augustine has a layered past that gives it a distinctly European feel. Quote, visitors often remark, I crossed the bridge and thought I was in Europe. Close quote, says Barbara Golden, communications PR manager for St. Augustine, Vendra, and the Beaches VCB. Quote, ornate facades, historic courtyards, centuries-old landmarks, walled-in gardens, and pedestrian-friendly streets create an atmosphere more reminiscent of the Mediterranean than a typical Florida beach town. Easily accessible from Jacksonville and Orlando airports, St. Augustine also has many European-style inns, including Casa Monica Resort and Spa with its Moorish Revival architecture, arched courtyards, and Mediterranean ambiance. According to Golden, many culinary offerings also pay homage to Spanish roots, including readily available authentic tapas, Menorcan specialties, and award-winning restaurants like the historic Columbia restaurant, known for traditional Spanish and Cuban dishes. Quote, there's even a chocolate factory that tells the story of Spain's introduction of chocolate to the world, close quote, says Golden. Considering the city dates back to 1565, history buffs should check out the Castillo de San Marcos, which is a 17th-century Spanish fortress overlooking the bay, or Aviles Street, the oldest street in the city that feels remarkably similar to navigating a narrow European alley. Fredericksburg, Texas. Texas might conjure images of barbecue and rodeos, but in Fredericksburg, brisket makes way for Wiener Schnitzel. Quote, the German community is very strong in Fredericksburg. There are 5th, 6th, 7th generation families that are still living here, close quote, says Mackenzie Mullering, who leads marketing and communications for Pioneer Museum Fredericksburg, which shares a glimpse into how German settlers lived in the 1800s following the town's founding in 1846. Quote, our historic Main Street does not have any chain stores and will never because the city has made an effort to keep it unique, close quote, says Mullering. Quote, Fredericksburg has shopping, a booming wine industry, history dating back to the 1840s, and over 120 restaurants, many of which serve authentic German cuisine. Local favorites include Old German Bakery and Restaurant or Otto's German Bistro, while beer lovers should stop by Fredericksburg Brewing Company. October visits are also well-timed for Fredericksburg Oktoberfest, when the town square buzzes with polka music, family-friendly activities, and plenty of ice-cold pints of German beer. Visitors may stay in one of the area's Sunday houses. These historic small homes, many of which are now vacation rentals, were once second residences for our farmers who traveled long distances from their remote ranches to attend church on Sunday. Solvang, California. Tucked within the vineyards of California's central coast, Solvang was founded in 1911 by a group of Danish-American educators. Over a century later, Solvang, which means sunny field, still looks authentically Danish. Quote, visitors can enjoy Danish architecture, bakeries, museums, traditions, and festivals, all within a walkable village setting, close quote, said Shelby Sim, president and CEO of Visit the Santa Ynez Valley. Dotted around Solvang are wooden windmills, there are four within a four-mile radius, as well as Danish provincial-style half-timbered buildings with thatched roofs and multiple museums, including the Solvang Viking Museum, Elverhoge Museum of History and Art, and the Hans Christian Andersen Museum. While strolling through town, keep an eye out for exact replicas of famous Danish landmarks. The Rundetårn, for example, a one-third replica of Copenhagen's famed Round Tower, while the Little Mermaid statue pays homage to the one watching over the shores of Copenhagen. Solvang is also well-suited for sweet-tooth visitors, with bakeries lining their cases with fresh-baked kringle, butter cookies, strudel, and fraudeboller, which are similar to cream puffs. For a hearty meal, Bit of Denmark's was built in 1911 as one of the town's first structures and serves Danish specialties like pan-fried meatballs and roast duck. Moving to Barron's magazine, Jamie Dimon sees an end on the horizon, but not yet. This is written by Andy Senwer and Rebecca Ungarino. Jamie Dimon is telling us all about his plans. He wants to start a news outlet that covers public policy, appealing to quote-unquote nerds like me, Dimon says. There's always government service like Treasury Secretary, quote, it's too late for me to run for president, close quote. He could stay on as chairman of J.P. Morgan Chase after he steps down as CEO, or maybe he'll write a book. And he'd like to own a bar. So many options, though sorting through them will come later. For now, Dimon has his hands full running the nation's largest bank, which he intends to do for at least 3 or 4 more years, quote-unquote board willing, he says. Besides, he already has a bar called Morgan's at the company's new audacious $4 billion Manhattan headquarters. The elegant, amenity-filled interior of the Norman Foster-designed 1,388-foot tower belies the real work still to be done. Dimon's remit has arguably never been more challenging. It isn't just a war in the Middle East or that the Trump administration poses unprecedented uncertainty or that the bank faces a raft of new competitors in payments, crypto, private equity, and credit and fintech. And it isn't just that many of J.P. Morgan's competitors, even Citigroup and Wells Fargo, are in good shape too, or that artificial intelligence could reorder the bank's business, or that risk from exposure to private credit loans could worsen. It isn't even that. Yes, Dimon needs to name a successor at some point. Dimon's biggest test is simply topping what he has already done. No easy task at J.P. Morgan after decades of world-beating success. J.P. Morgan Chase, under Dimon, the most consequential banker of his generation, has rocked the banking world. It bought and integrated First Republic, helping to stamp out the banking kerfuffle of 2023 in the process. It took over the Apple Card with its $20 billion of customer accounts, following the iPhone maker's troubled collaboration with Goldman Sachs Group. The bank launched an effort to oversee $1.5 trillion of investments in U.S. national security and hired Todd Combs, one of Warren Buffett's key lieutenants, to help run it. And there's the new building, which takes up a whole city block in the middle of the densest, priciest section of Manhattan, which came with Dimon's 5-day in-office mandate for employees. And as for Dimon himself, he has hit some milestones too, recently marking his 20th anniversary as CEO and his 70th birthday on Friday the 13th. Then there's this. Since Dimon became CEO on January 1st, 2006, J.P. Morgan's stock is up 626% versus 429% for the S&P 500 index and 43% for the KBW Bank Index. J.P. Morgan's $777 billion market value makes it the biggest bank in the world, larger than Bank of America, Wells Fargo, and Citigroup. It's three legacy competitors combined. Dimon has been rewarded for his trouble. According to research firm Equilar, he has taken home a total of $1 billion in compensation during his tenure. Shocking, perhaps, but note that he has helped the bank's market cap grow by $636 billion. It's all pretty impressive, but as a reminder of how fleeting success and legacy can be, JPM's stock year-to-date is down over 10%, lagging behind both the S&P 500 and the bank index. As we head into what looks to be Dimon's stretch run, he and his team are determined to keep the winning streak alive. Barron's spoke with Dimon and many of his top deputies in their 47th floor offices, including a nearly 2-hour sit-down with Dimon. The bank's leaders addressed challenges from relentless competition and shifting political winds to succession. Opportunities abound, they believe. Beyond internal growth, quote, we are looking like a hawk at M&A, mergers and acquisitions, close quote, says Mary Callahan Erdos, who leads J.P. Morgan's asset and wealth management group. Quote, dining is a huge category for us. Travel is an even bigger category, close quote, consumer banking chief Marianne Lake says. The investment bank, says co-head Doug Petno, can expand in Turkey, Australia, Japan, and the Middle East. Seated in his office beneath a retroflective vinyl American flag created by New York artist Hank Willis Thomas, Dimon says all of his businesses can grow organically. Difficult, he says, but preferable to acquisitions. Competing in sales and trading is, quote, like trench warfare, close quote, says the ever-blunt CEO, his left hand wrapped in a cast from a recent surgery for bone spurs. Diamond's office, where he gave us his first interview since moving in, is as much a reflection of his career, J.P. Morgan in America, as it is a room for work. Certified replicas of the 1804 dueling pistols used by Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, who co-founded J.P. Morgan's earliest predecessor firm, lie in velvet casing. He has two Smith Barney bookends, one a bull, one a bear, a 2010 New York Times Magazine cover featuring Diamond dubbed, quote, America's least hated banker, close quote, hangs on the wall. There's a framed photo of Diamond and actor Bill Pullman, who portrayed him in the 2011 film Too Big to Fail. That was then, though. Now Diamond is steering his firm through President Donald Trump's second term, which has been marked by volatility, even attacks on Diamond himself. On January 22nd, Trump sued the bank and Diamond over claims of so-called debanking. Quote, we don't use that word, close quote, Diamond says when we ask about the complaint. Quote, it's exiting clients, close quote. Any update there? Quote, I'm not going to talk about specific accounts, close quote, Diamond says. Quote, he has the right to sue us. We have the right to defend ourselves. That's what courts are for. Diamond says he hasn't met with Trump since he filed the lawsuit. They briefly saw each other at the Alfalfa Club's annual dinner in Washington, D.C. on January 31st. Diamond is on board with Kevin Warsh, Trump's selection for Federal Reserve Chair. Quote, I believe he'll try to be independent. He's a smart person. He knows his job, close quote, he says. Quote, but that doesn't mean President Trump won't try to. President Trump's going to say what he wants to say, close quote. J.P. Morgan operates three core divisions, consumer and community banking, catering to Main Street, commercial and investment banking, Wall Street, and the asset and wealth management group, investors and very wealthy people. Its Wall Street and Main Street engines drove some 42% and 41% of revenue in 2025, respectively. The asset and wealth management business is the smallest, but also the most profitable. The company, which made $57 billion in net profit in 2025 after a record $58.5 billion the prior year, has a champagne problem. Tens of billions of dollars in excess capital, so-called on Wall Street because it's well above regulatory minimums. J.P. Morgan could use its billions to buy back shares, fund an acquisition, or invest in activities like lending. Quote, we're going to deploy capital, close quote, Jeremy Barnum, J.P. Morgan's chief financial officer, said last month. Quote, we're going to grow risk-weighted assets. We've done buybacks, we've done dividends, and all the other organic and inorganic opportunities are always on the table, close quote. J.P. Morgan's enormous technology budget, disclosed for the first time recently, is eye-popping. Of the $105 billion in expenses, J.P. Morgan projects for this year, tech should account for some $20 billion alone, roughly the revenue of the rival bank of New York Mellon, driven in part by increased costs of software and investments in AI and machine learning. Ellen Hazen, chief market strategist and portfolio manager at F.L. Putnam Investment Management, says she has been encouraged to hear about those plans in the name of growth. Quote, if you end up with technology being a differentiator within the banking universe, I have confidence that J.P. Morgan will be one of the leaders at the expense of smaller banks that can't afford to make investments, close quote, says Hazen, whose firm owns 335,000 J.P. Morgan shares. J.P. Morgan's investment bank is using that tech to hold on to clients. After losing some clients to rivals, the business led by Petno and Troy Robaugh created a tool to measure client interactions and notify bankers if clients need more attention. Investment bankers can now write an S-1 filing, a key document companies must file before going public. Quote, agentically, in a matter of hours, trained off of all the S-1s we've written in the past, close quote, Petno says. Human beings are also in the mix. We also speak with Robaugh, whose office is dotted with odes to Baltimore, his hometown. He talks about growing the business by offering increasingly sophisticated services, citing Marks and Spencer, the retailer in the United Kingdom, where he lived earlier in his career. Shoppers go there to buy everyday staples, milk, and fancy foodstuffs, caviar. That amounts to hiring fewer junior bankers, which poses a challenge to training new bankers in what has been a classic apprenticeship model, one executive says. AI investment bankers are already making a splash. Quote, more often than not, the basis of your relationship is the milk, bread, and butter, close quote, Rarbaugh says. It's foreign exchange, sovereign repo, swaps trading, treasury trading. It's all of these things the client expects from us. But we have the ability to scale that up into higher value services, close quote. The sprawling consumer business is led by Marianne Lake, the odds-on favorite, according at least to prediction markets, to eventually replace Diamond. Consumer and community banking houses about 45% of the firm's workforce of 320,000 and counts some 5,000 branches, with $86.6 million individual customers and 7.4 million small businesses. Asked whether she would accept the CEO job if she were offered it tomorrow, Lake, seated on the couch in her corner office, laughs. Quote, it is unwise of me to spend huge amounts of time trying to answer that question, close quote, she says. Quote, I love my job. I love this company. I love working on this team. The board has that to work out. I want to play my role in that, whatever that is, honestly. That could be in a supporting cast role, and I would be happy with that, too, close quote. Down the hall, Jeremy Barnum shows us a paperweight gift from a colleague. It reads, quote, I am silently judging your spreadsheet, close quote. The line may need updating. Quote, I think the days of me being Mr. Spreadsheet Guy are kind of over, close quote, Barnum jokes. Quote, I'm now Claude Code Guy, close quote. He pulls up a dashboard for Claude, an AI tool from Anthropic, showing a sample question about the bank's branch strategy. Callahan Erdos has run the asset management arm and private bank, where clients typically need some $25 million to get in the door, since 2009. Now she looks to international expansion, private markets, hiring more private bankers, and M&A for growth. She says she prioritizes premium products, then scale, not the reverse. Quote, I could offer one basis point fee, ETFs tomorrow, and I could have another $10 billion in a heartbeat, close quote, Callahan Erdo says. Quote, but you won't be the best the next day, close quote. A basis point is 1/100th of a percentage point. Quote, there's still massive room to grow, particularly internationally, where active ETFs are just beginning, close quote, she says in her office. Where a Diamond Erdos 24 election-style baseball cap, a gift from a client, hangs on a shelf. Says Hazen, the portfolio manager. Quote, I think they're hitting on all cylinders, but it's a nicely valued stock. It's not as though it's crazy cheap, but I think they're navigating this environment very well, close quote. Diamond would say he's navigating the same as he ever was. The bank's longstanding strategy is to offer customers a one-stop shop experience so that as clients accumulate wealth and grow, they become more intertwined with all of J.P. Morgan Chase. As such, Diamond and his team are trying to balance two paradoxical messages. The first, cast the bank's unrivaled size, $4.4 trillion in total assets, 90% of the Fortune 500 as clients, 116 million credit card accounts, and $12 trillion of daily payments, as an advantage only J.P. Morgan can offer. The second, remind investors that actually it isn't that dominant and still has plenty of room to grow. Which is fine, except the strategy isn't exactly earth-shattering, nor is it that different from what competitors like Bank of America or Citigroup are offering up. Diamond acknowledges as much. Quote, quote, I assume there's going to be tough competition, close quote, he says. Quote, they all have smart people. They're all gunning for the same kind of client, close quote. If the strategy isn't unique, J.P. Morgan's execution is. The proof, executives say, shows up two ways. The first, operating results. Over the past decade, its market share in trading and security services, fees for managing institutional money on the commercial side, and retail deposits and credit cards on the consumer side are all but more than 200 basis points, where each point is potentially worth millions of dollars. The second scoreboard is the stock market's response to those gains, which has been hugely endorsing. Diamond's 20-year run has seen any number of bumps and failures as well as opportunity costs such as, Diamond says, not developing fintech efforts like Stripe or SoFi, acquisitions of Washington Mutual and Bear Stearns, which cost the bank millions in fines and litigations, were a mixed bag. Its investment in Greek fintech Viva Wallet has devolved into a legal rat's nest. Its high-profile 2021 $175 million purchase of Frank, a fintech startup designed to help students navigate financial aid, ended up being mostly an empty shell. Bigger and scarier was the London Whale scandal, a a huge derivatives trade that went south in 2012 to the tune of a $6 billion loss to J.P. Morgan, more than $900 million in fines, and a 50% pay cut for Diamond. Quote, there's been an enormous amount of work, both externally imposed by regulators and internally driven by us, to learn the lessons and implement the relevant adjustments, close quote, says Barnum of the Whale Broglio. Quote, if we thought it could never happen again, we wouldn't need a risk team, close quote. Diamond also had two major health scares. In July 2014, the CEO announced he had throat cancer, which he later informed investors was treated successfully by that December. And in March 2020, as COVID-19 was encircling the globe, doctors discovered Diamond had an acute aortic dissection, a tear in the inner layer of the body's main artery, requiring immediate emergency surgery. Diamond was back in the office that June. Whether J.P. Morgan's high-flying run extends beyond Diamond remains to be seen. But that's 3 or 4 or 5 or more years off. For now, Jamie and company have work aplenty. Investors will be watching. And now on to Fortune magazine. How Netflix Swallowed Hollywood by Natalie Jarvie. It's a story so good it could have been a screenplay. In 2000, Reed Hastings and Mark Randolph sat down across from John Antioco, then CEO of video rental giant Blockbuster, and pitched him on acquiring their still unprofitable DVD-by-mail startup, Netflix, which at the time had around 300,000 subscribers. But when they told him that their price, $50 million, and the chance to develop and run Blockbuster's online rental business, Antioco balked. It was a famously short-sighted business decision. By 2010, Blockbuster had filed for bankruptcy, and Netflix had stormed Hollywood with its entertainment streaming service. Now Netflix, a behemoth that has moved far beyond streaming others' films and shows, with an estimated $18 billion content spend for 2025, is writing the sequel, following the same underdog-to-winner trope. It announced in early December an $82.7 billion deal to become the new owner of the storied Warner Brothers film and television studios, plus cable crown jewel HBO and streamer HBO Max. The deal comes some 15 years after an executive who previously oversaw those very assets dismissed the notion of Netflix being a threat to Hollywood's power structures. Jeff Bukes, then CEO of Warner Brothers, parent Time Warner, described that scenario in 2010 as, quote, a little bit like, is the Albanian army going to take over the world, close quote. To be sure, Netflix has never before attempted a deal of this size, and with rival Paramount making a play for the entire Warner Brothers Discovery business through a hostile bid, a Netflix-Warner Brothers tie-up is still far from a sure thing. But even if the deal never actually materializes, Netflix has demonstrated how to not just disrupt an industry, but swallow it. It's a trajectory that's all the more impressive, given the company's scrappy dot-com era start. Quote, Netflix should have never existed, close quote, says Peter Cipino, who analyzes the media and entertainment industries as managing director at Wolf Research. Quote, their path relied on a bunch of strategic decisions that were risky and uncertain at times, and the body of which proved out to be smashingly correct, close quote. To dominate streaming today, of course, is to dominate all of entertainment, and Netflix now has a market cap, almost $400 billion currently. That exceeds the combined value of legacy competitors Disney, Warner Brothers, Discovery, Fox Corporation, Paramount, and Lionsgate. So just how did Netflix do it? The company has built a culture that fosters flexibility and daring and has repeatedly shown its adeptness at taking calculated risks, including a series of strategic U-turns. Netflix was never going to make original television shows and movies until it ponied up an unprecedented $100 million for 2 seasons of House of Cards from executive producer David Fincher in 2011, sight unseen without a pilot. Netflix didn't care about password sharing until it began rigorously enforcing a quote-unquote one-household rule in 2023. Netflix was never going to introduce live streaming or advertising until it added both within a few months in 2022 and 2023, then struck its first major sports rights deal, another one-time no-go, in 2024. And Netflix was never going to go all in on theatrical releases until it decided to buy Warner Brothers and pledged to distribute its films to movie theaters. Quote, "We've built a great business, and to do that, we've had to be bold and continue to evolve," close quote, co-CEO Ted Sarandos told investors on the call announcing the deal. Quote, "We can't stand still. We need to keep innovating and investing in stories that matter most to audiences," close quote. Call it innovating or call it misleading the competition, most people agree that Netflix has offered a masterclass in audacious strategy. In his business tome, No Rules Rules, Netflix and the Culture of Reinvention, Hastings offers guidelines for strategic pivots, pointing out that, quote, "the vast majority of firms fail when their industry shifts," close quote. The former CEO, who kicked himself upstairs to chairman in 2023, attributes the company's success to a culture that prioritizes innovation, motivates top performers, and has few controls, allowing Netflix, quote, "to continually grow and change as the world and our members' needs have likewise morphed around us," close quote. This is antithetical to how business is usually done in Hollywood, where studio executives would rather bet on proven IP with sequels, spin-offs, reboots, and copycats than stick their necks out for new untested ideas. A bolder approach has given Netflix the upper hand. Quote, "We were willing to take the risk that these other companies were willing to take because they were so stuck on what made them successful in the first place," close quote, says Jessica Neal, former chief talent officer at Netflix. This approach means also accepting what Neal calls the tax of sometimes disappointing customers in the short term in service of a bigger goal. Case in point, Netflix's short-lived plan to split its DVD-by-mail operations into a separate unit called Quixtar in 2011, while arguably necessary to maintain the focus on streaming growth, annoyed customers, and its execution was seen as a rare blunder for the company. Quote, "Companies do themselves a massive disservice because they look at mistakes as failures, and we looked at mistakes as learning," close quote, says Neal, who worked almost 12 years in talent-focused roles during two stints at Netflix. Quote, "But you have to teach people how to do it, and we did. And you also have to hire people that have the appetite to do it." That once scrappy DVD-by-mail company now employs around 14,000 people worldwide. And after nearly 30 years of strategic pivots, little of Netflix's original business model remains in place. Yet, remarkably, the company's internal corporate culture remains relatively unchanged. It's that work environment and what Cipino calls an unsentimental culture that just might be its secret weapon. In 2009, Netflix published a 125-slide culture deck on how it has become such a high-functioning workplace. The memo has been updated several times, but it continues to emphasize a handful of unique concepts, including freedom over processes, leading with context, not control, and a commitment to candor, even for a specialty, when it's uncomfortable. As Hastings' book acknowledges, Netflix's culture is weird. The company doesn't keep track of vacation or expenses. It champions internal transparency around performance data and executive salaries. And to ensure it's only employing people at the top of their game, the company famously applies a quote-unquote keeper test, essentially an employee review where bosses ask themselves, quote, "If X wanted to leave, would I fight to keep them?" close quote, to decide who is delivering real results and who should be let go. Some very senior executives have exited the company in accordance with those principles, including Patty McCord, the company's original chief talent officer and one of the architects of its corporate culture. Quote, "We were very focused on feedback and having tough conversations that people don't want to have," close quote, says Neal. Quote, "And we believe that telling the truth to somebody was actually caring and it was uncaring to do the opposite," close quote. "This helps teams communicate during rough patches," he says. Quote, "We were actually able to navigate those things much more effectively because we were able to talk about the tough stuff," close quote. Take the moment all those years ago when Time Warner's CEO shrugged Netflix off as the quote-unquote Albanian army. And what could be a scene straight out of the official Netflix movie, a comment intended as an insult, instead galvanized the troops. Hastings reportedly gifted top executives camouflage berets featuring the double-headed eagle from the flag of Albania, and Neal remembers staff wearing Albanian army dog tags, quote-unquote, with pride. Even back then, they knew they'd eventually get their Hollywood ending. Here is the foreword of this issue by the editor-in-chief, Allison Chantel. President or CEO of USA Inc., ? What is it like to be a Fortune 500 CEO during the second Trump administration? I ask that question every time I meet with one in a closed-door setting. In the recent conversations, the answers have been remarkably similar. This president is pro-business, and that's a refreshing change from the last administration. Quote, "It feels like he wants us to win," close quote, one CEO remarked. Some have said they receive phone calls directly from President Trump, and not infrequently, asking for ideas or feedback. Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla, for example, told me Trump used to call weekly during the early days of COVID, asking about how the vaccine was going and in what ways the FDA could help. The president you see in public is not who these executives describe in private, where the deals are being made. And maybe the American government could use more business-like thinking. The United States is the capital of capitalism, with the world's top innovators, and yes, the most and wealthiest billionaires as a result. Meanwhile, we have a national debt that has ballooned, a devastating wealth divide, and a looming AI wave that threatens to wipe out lower-paid jobs first. If you think of the U.S. as a business in need of a financial overhaul, what would a turnaround CEO do? They'd throw out the old playbook, size up the operation, ditch inefficiencies, place new bets, and move as fast as possible to right the ship, paying no mind to detractors. The CEO president is an experiment we are all witnessing firsthand. As Trump pushes boundaries, including legal ones, tests new revenue streams, tariffs, pushes for equity stakes in place of government subsidies, and driving his agenda aggressively forward in a move fast, make or break America approach, outcome TBD. There's also the question of where the line is between what's good for America, what's good for business, and what's good for the president himself, with sometimes murky overlap. We explore his approach and all those questions in this issue with an analysis of how President Trump draws inspiration from his deal-making background to tackle his job like he's the CEO of USA Inc. We also take a look inside one of the Trump family's operations, Eric Trump's new venture, American Bitcoin, as he seeks to become one of the world's biggest miners and holders of Bitcoin, while separating his cryptocurrency agency from his father's. Donald Trump, quote, "has no involvement in our crypto business," close quote, Eric told Fortune. Quote, "This is a company that I run, and he does a great job running the United States of America," close quote. You'll also find a profile of Google's AI mastermind, Demi Hassabis, a look at how Netflix conquered Hollywood, and our 28th World's Most Admired Companies ranking, where executives across the Fortune 500 vote for the peers they look up to. As always, thank you for reading Fortune. You've been listening to Down to Business. My name's Greg Conroy. This has been brought to you by the folks at Mind's Eye Organization, helping the low vision and blind communities in the St. Louis region since 1973. Have a great week. Take care.